House Transportation Committee to order, and we will first off open a public hearing on House Bill 2217. And Janet, can you catch us up to speed where we're at with that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. House Bill 2217 was the bill you had an initial hearing on March 31st. This is the bill that would bring Oregon into compliance with federal motor carrier safety regulations. And the main provision in it that is being discussed is the issue about authority to inspect interstate trucks carrying goods in interstate commerce, especially farm trucks, because Oregon statute currently exempts trucks carrying goods in interstate commerce from state inspections. They are currently subject to federal inspection. Mr. Chair, we didn't finish the hearing. We ran out of time that day, and two people were not, we didn't get two people on the list, so that's what the hearing is continuing for today. And there were questions, actually these guys did come up, but there were questions during the meeting, and so we thought those might want to be answered.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Could I have Greg Belponte and Andrew Eno, please? Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Greg Belponte, administrator of the Motor Carrier Division for ODOT. And first of all, I apologize for having to prematurely leave the last meeting and discussion on this subject. I was called away to the Ways and Means Committee, and I understand that there were a couple of questions that were left on the table that I'd like to speak to this morning. Specifically, I understand that the committee heard testimony from farmers that specifically asked, A, could they self-certify as to the mechanical condition of their trucks? Or alternatively, would it be possible to have all of the farm trucks pre-inspected prior to harvest season? And I'd like to share some information with you on both of those issues today. Actually, I think that there's a helpful distinction here and a clarification that I can make that will help us sort through some of those issues. And while what you've heard may have sounded commonsensical to you, there's a reason why I believe those will not be satisfactory or possible solutions. First of all, there more or less is a self-certification process in place, but it needs to be distinguished from a separate process. Now, let me explain. Every interstate motor carrier has a requirement under existing federal motor carrier safety regulations to either inspect themselves or arrange to be inspected every piece of equipment that they're going to put on the road. And that inspection, either done by a farmer who's competent in such things or by an outside vendor, is to specifically look at a list of mechanical items that is listed and delineated in federal regulations. The result of that inspection, if satisfactory, is to be recorded and kept in the vehicle at all times while it's on the road. The fact that that document, that receipt, or that invoice from a repair shop is in the vehicle and testifies to the fact that the truck was deemed safe and satisfactory at the point in time the inspection was done, does not serve to deter a roadside safety inspection in the field. An entirely different process results when the truck is randomly stopped by a state or a federal employee, a law enforcement individual, for the purposes of conducting a truck safety inspection. That officer will go through a checklist of requirements. They're going to look at the truck, and they're going to look at the driver. They're going to go through the checklist. Is there a CDL if one's necessary? Is it in date? Does the driver have a medical card? They're going to look at hours of service issues. They're then going to ask, is the annual certification of mechanical, fitness in place? Then they're going to go through their own checklist, and they're going to look at the truck and trailer. If everything is satisfactory, a Commercial Vehicle Safety Administration, or CVSA, you've probably heard the acronym DECAL, is affixed to the windshield of the truck. And for those of you that attended our tour at the Woodburn Port of Entry, you saw us place CVSA decals on the windshield of a truck. Those CVSA decals applied as a result of a robust, what we call a level one inspection, will serve to deter a subsequent safety inspection if that truck is encountered again on a random basis by a roadside safety inspection. But the two are not the same. The annual inspection of the vehicle is a motor carrier responsibility. It's done by the motor carrier. It's done by the farmer. It's not done by the state or its agents. The roadside inspection done by a law enforcement agent is accomplished, obviously, by state resources and can result in a CVSA decal. That decal can preclude additional safety inspections. The annual certification done by the motor carrier will not.
But the question is, could I come in for a level one inspection and get that decal in advance of the harvest season? That's the issue here. The issue here is to prevent hanging up for 45 minutes or whatever it takes to do a level one safety inspection. And could I, getting ready for the harvest season, show up, do a level one inspection, and get a decal? That's the question I was raising.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlight, I'm going to speak to that very issue. I was address them in order, if that's satisfactory. Okay, so that's okay. I wanted to speak first to the issue of the self-certification. Now, to move on then to the second question, is it possible to pre-inspect the equipment? There's a couple of things that I think bear on that question. First of all, it is an inappropriate and an unauthorized use of the MCSAP federal safety funds to conduct inspections of equipment on a pre-scheduled, pre-arranged basis. The purpose of the MCSAP grant funds and the grant requirement is that those dollars are used for unscheduled roadside random observations. Now, that's a grant requirement. And so all the staff that are functioning and being paid for by the MCSAP grant are precluded from engaging in the suggestion of pre-inspecting the equipment. Now, the reasoning for that, I won't speak for the federal government. Andy's here. He can comment additionally. But I believe that the interpretation guidance that it's been given in the past by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is that a prearranged inspection of trucks at a terminal does not allow for the concurrent inspection of the driver. And safety data makes it abundantly clear that truck at fault accidents very seldom derive from a mechanical deficiency. They more likely derive from either a driver behavior or an inadequacy or a disqualification of the driver. And therefore, it's the intent of the federal government that these federal grant funds be expended in such a way that they will result in the simultaneous inspection of both the equipment and the driver. So that then takes us to, how about state-funded employees? Can state-funded employees perform these pre-harvest season inspections? And there it's important to note that I have 97 motor carrier enforcement officers who are principally responsible for size and weight enforcement, although 5% of their position duties entail truck inspection activity. And I have about 39 other employees that are full-time safety inspectors. But think for a moment. I've got over 26,000 registered motor carriers with a combined registered fleet of well over 300,000 trucks. And they routinely, for the same reason the farm industry is asking, can we have our trucks pre-inspected? Can we come by a port of entry? Can you send over an officer? We'd like to have you go through our trucks, check them, and put decals on them so we're not stopped roadside. There is no practical way that with 97 part-time staff and 39 full-time staff, I can possibly satisfactorily address the workload that 300,000-plus trucks represents. I'd suggest also that since the question's been routinely asked and routinely denied in the past, that to make an exception for the farm community in this regard would engender expressions of an unlevel playing field and a disproportionate treatment of a single trucking industry. Now, having said all that, I've acknowledged and I'll repeat again that I understand farmers have a legitimate concern that roadside checks, especially an unduly high level of them, may reasonably interfere with their movement of their farm harvest to production or processing facilities. I understand that. I've tried to communicate that we have a performance-based program and we would not unduly focus on farm trucks, especially during an abbreviated harvest season. I think you've heard some testimony that the likelihood of of any given truck being singled out for a roadside inspection in the course of a year is rather diminutive. It's very small. Now, having said that, I'd also like to acknowledge that we are capable of lapses in judgment in the field. And the chair asked me to comment about a situation that occurred in the past year in his district. And I think it's an illustration of what can happen when things go wrong in the field. And in this particular situation, there was a continuous stream of trucks moving from an asphalt yard to a paving project. And my employees and state police employees and other law enforcement employees working together unfortunately stopped virtually every single truck in the stream of traffic, detoured them off the highway, circled them a mile and a half to a large parking lot, and weighed and inspected a great many of them. That was fair and legitimate criticism. When it was brought to our attention, we stopped. Now, the gentleman that was responsible for the operation of the dump trucks made the same request that the farmers asked. Could you come to my facility and weigh all my trucks before they leave? Could you come to my facility and inspect all my trucks before they operate so that I'll never again be stopped on the roadside? I understand the origin of the request, but I think that's the incorrect solution. The correct solution is to do what we did in this circumstance. And we use it as a learning opportunity. We're capable of a lapse in judgment. We're also capable of learning from it. And so we use this as a learning experience, and we instructed our staff and our law enforcement partners that when they observe an uninterrupted flow of truck traffic coming to and going from the same place, obviously all as part of an ongoing function like a paving project or filling up a grain elevator, if, in fact, our purposes require and our data-driven, performance-driven process requires that we stop a few trucks, it's sufficient that we sample that traffic stream and stop one or two, make a determination, and move on without encumbering the paving project or the harvest procedure from proceeding. And I think we can do that with reason. So I'd summarize by saying I understand the concern. I think we have the wherewithal through effective management, careful supervision, and adherence to a performance-driven safety plan that you've now heard about on several occasions to do what makes practical sense without inflicting unnecessary, undue delay on the farm industry during the course of harvest. And the specific requests that were made of can we pre-certify or can we self-certify, those are either unlawful or problematic. So I'll stop there and answer any questions you may have.
Greg, I'll make a comment regarding the incident that happened in my district, and thank you for the high degree of professionalism you displayed and used in rectifying that situation there. I really appreciate it. And I know the operator did, too.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
I have a couple questions about the CVSA.
Yes, sir.
It says here only a valid and current CVSA works, receives a decal. How long is that CVSA good for?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, a decal is good for a calendar quarter.
Okay. So that would be like a harvest period.
Yes.
For example. And that is to certify that the truck and the driver and everything was satisfactory.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, that's correct. The intent is, since this is a national program and all states use the CVSA decals and all states participate in the MXAP program to one extent or another, so that the interstate truck that was inspected in Oregon on Monday won't be inspected in California needlessly on Tuesday and perhaps again on Wednesday in Arizona.
Okay, then my follow-up question is, you know, this is all done in the interest of safety, but my farm truck gets stopped and inspected today, and I get a decal that's good for 3 months, and I go home and drive out in the field and do some damage to that farm truck that would render it unsafe, and put my 15-year-old grandson in the driver's seat because he's big enough to drive and can get away with it, and he drives down the road with a sticker on the windshield and is exempt from being stopped. I find that incredible, and I find that you know, if we're going to, you know, certify the object of this is safety, that somebody can't come in and say, I'm willing to pay a fee to have my truck safety inspected now for the amount of the harvest, why we can't accommodate that some way. I just, it doesn't make sense to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, in essence, what we would need to do in order to make that happen is we would have to allow for third-party inspectors. It exceeds the workforce that I have available. So we would have to allow for third-party inspectors to perform the inspection that is reserved currently for law enforcement personnel and to apply that decal. Today, that is disallowed by the federal government. So I'd have to turn to Andy Eno and ask him to comment.
Chairman, Representative Mabry, I do want to point out something. Even though you do have a CVSA sticker that is good for 90 days, you are still subject to a probable cause stop if, for example, they notice that the state police, whoever notices that, you know, this driver standing on the seat to see over the dashboard, or there's, you know, a wheel that's, you know, flopping in the breeze. I mean, they still could at that point pull them over and do another inspection. I do need to clarify that. The idea is just to make sure that, you know, that we aren't inspecting those that have been inspected. You know, we're not needlessly holding them up on especially like a random type inspection. But on probable cause, they still could, and they are expected to. So.
Representative Greenwood.
Greg, let's say this went in place and you had enough money to hire more staff, seasonal staff, to do this at a particular point in time. But how much do you expect, and I know this is a sort of guess, it might cost to have a truck getting a level one inspection in the farm season in, say, the second bay at your facility in Woodburn, or a similar place, an off-hours inspection, if you needed to get the fee to be sufficient to hire seasonal help to do that inspection of your own?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, I think the best way for me to answer that question would be to tell you that to complete a level one truck inspection at one of my port of entry facilities takes approximately 35 minutes. There's very little material consumed, and so we're basically talking about the cost of labor and the cost of the facility operation, lights and heat.
So it might be as little as, say, $100, $150 or something like that would cover your ability to put more staff on if it were organized in some way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, I think $100 as a cost is certainly a reasonable approximation, but I would say to you that kind of work would be above and beyond and outside of our regulatory program. And rather than diminish the kinds of activities that we know today are having the desired positive effect on our program missions, if we were to do that, I'd like to see that done on an overtime basis. So we're not diminishing our regularly occurring work. We're attending to our mission. And I would suggest to you that doing it on an overtime basis, there is a point of diminishing returns. And there is a significant volume here. There's 26,000 motor carriers and 300,000 trucks that at one time or another have expressed an interest in this sort of program.
Representative Gilman.
Greg, we on the committee, I think, are realizing that you probably won't be stopping ag vehicles. But put yourself in the position of the ag community. We've had a system going for years that's worked very well. We have no safety problems. We don't have accidents. How do we explain to our constituents that we added this another layer of inspection just because the Fed said we needed to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilman, well, you've articulated the first reason. We've done it because it's the federal government has informed us it's a requirement, and it's not just a requirement for the grant. If, in fact, we don't pass a bill like 2217, it's very possible that Governor Kulongowski will get a letter from USDOT Secretary Normanetta, which amounts to a preliminary determination of preemption. The state law could be preempted through a federal rulemaking process. So that's one reason. The second reason might be not to sell it, but to communicate why you've acceded to this and why you've passed House Bill 2217 is because it's a uniform requirement, and to our knowledge, there's not another state that doesn't comply with this. And in fact, to our knowledge, when a state did not comply, it was the state of Mississippi, they did in fact receive that letter of preemption, and their law was preempted. And the third reason would be that while a farm truck is one usage of a truck is a truck, and the trucking industry itself is very diverse. I mean, general freight, logging, farm trucks, dump trucks, sand and gravel. There's a certain modicum of common sense here that says that trucks should be treated alike in this regard, and that our safety program and our safety results have established that we are achieving good societal outcomes in Oregon. Truck at fault accidents have declined in each of the last 4 years in a row, based on our application of this safety plan in the manner that I've described it. I would attempt to explain it in that way to the farm community.
Representative Greenland.
Thank you, sir. Greg, I'm willing to support this bill because it makes obvious sense to support it, but I'm also very sensitive to the concerns of the agricultural community, including those in my district, although I've not gotten a flock of mail on this from. I'm more worried about the Northwest Natural Pipeline, but and they really trust you. I think the farm community really had a lot of expressions of confidence in you. I would hope if this passes, that you'll put in place a sort of close monitoring system on what goes on during the first couple of seasons to be very responsive to changes. Or to concerns of the farm communities that actually applies. And I mean, my assumption is that you could do something like that and that you, in fact, would do something like that. Is that?
Mr. Chairman,
I speak for you.
Representative Greenlick, I can assure you that on this subject and with this bill, with all the work that has been done during the interim and thus far in this session, that it has been uniquely etched upon my consciousness that there will be a great deal of concern and observation on how we manage this program going forward.
Andrew, did you have some testimony you wanted to give this morning too?
Chairman, I just wanted to be here in case there's any questions that needed to be.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Greg Palmer was kind enough, as you know, to meet with my farmers, and they're the people that did the etching. So I think we'll be the farmers around St. Paul. But he was very courteous, and I have total trust that we're not going to have any problems. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Many thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2217 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3510. And could I have Doug Tindall and Andrea Vogt come forward, please?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I did not have an opportunity to sign up. I wonder if I might.
Certainly.
You want me to start?
Go ahead.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, good morning. Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I've got some testimony I'm handing out. I'm going to sort of abbreviate that because many of the issues were discussed the other day when this bill was heard. Representative Verger brought out some of the advantages to doing jurisdictional transfers, and some of the committee noted some of the issues with taking that tool out of the toolbox. It was, however, the first time I've ever been accused of extortion. I said accused. the simple fact is we're not trying to be a bully and take anybody's lunch money. This is jurisdictional transfers are something that, as funds get tighter and priorities are set, the Transportation Commission is focused on maintaining the statewide routes. We definitely understand the impact that that has on local governments, and I think the simple fact is that you're seeing with this bill, I think, is sort of a symptom that there just simply isn't enough money to maintain all of the miles of roadway in this state. We've been working with our partners who have me surrounded today, and in a committee to talk about jurisdictional transfers and to make sure that when we do them, when we use this tool, we use it in agreement so that everybody's in agreement. Again, we're not trying to be the bully in this thing. So this is a tool that allows, I think, some projects that may not otherwise occur to occur, and it's something that we would not like to see taken away. We do have a fiscal impact on this because there are some upcoming projects that where jurisdictional transfers are contemplated, and should those not occur, then we would incur some cost in continuing to maintain the roadway. So there's a fiscal of a couple hundred thousand dollars on this bill. And with that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Committee, any questions? Don't look like it. And Andrea, Janet, you had a question?
We talked a little bit, excuse me, thank you, Mr. Chair, before the meeting about what the verb undertaking means as to when this would apply to projects that were approved, a project that just started construction, when you think the would apply.
Chair Brown, Ms. Adkins, thanks, Janet. I forgot to mention that. We're not positive what that would mean, whether that would impact projects that are already underway where a jurisdictional transfer is contemplated. However, in the fiscal analysis, we only considered projects that are not yet, which do not yet have an agreement written on them. So there may be some planning or there may be some design that's already done, but we haven't actually written the agreement with the local government yet.
Thank you, Doug. Andrea?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. You have heard most of the very relevant testimony on this bill. I'll just highlight a couple of things. You heard Representative Verger and also Representative Anderson talk about how this is a critical issue for local governments. It's something that, yes, in fact, can often become controversial. But what's good about jurisdictional transfers is that they are worked out by each community individually, either with another local government or with ODOT. And it is an issue that we continue to work on. Right now, we as cities and counties are in the process of developing a jurisdictional transfer manual or guidebook with ODOT to try to put some parameters and, again, guidance around the issue. We, cities and counties, have recently completed set of principles or guidelines, if you will, for local jurisdictional transfers. I'll tell you that the ODOT manual is like this and the local manual is like this. But regardless, we are continuing to work on these issues because it's something that we deal with all the time. And as Doug mentioned, we particularly are at a time where the maintenance funding is inadequate, and so you see that it puts a lot more stress on these agreements and the situation. So in terms of where we're at on this issue, we absolutely support that this must be a mutual agreement between either the state or the other local government entities to solve the issue on the local level and maintain the flexibility to create something that works for that particular agreement. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, I sort of hate to see a statute that requires the kids to play well together, and this really sort of is that kind of a statute. But that aside, it strikes me that if a local jurisdiction wants an improvement and they're not willing or not able, which I'm sure willing is not the issue, I'm sure able is the issue, not able to agree to accept the maintenance of that project, you do recognize that, or at least would it be true that that project would likely have a lower priority in the scoring system than a project for which there is maintenance agreements?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, I think it's going to depend on the situation. I think it's going to depend on probably the severity of the project, what that project means to the local government, to the state, to the region. So, again, I think it comes back to the individual agreement and priority of that project in terms of how that gets worked out. I would hope that in that situation, if in fact it is a significant priority for the community and for ODOT, that it would not come down to being less of a priority just because the funding was not available. But again, that is something that would be worked out among the parties.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andrea, I guess I'm a little confused on what you just said, and that is, do you support this bill or not?
The hard questions, Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer. We do not think that this bill significantly changes anything that we currently do in terms of discussing and getting these agreements ready between the state and a local government. We think that the piece of this bill that talks about not requiring that the match be part of a modernization project, that is currently part of the discussion that takes place between the local jurisdiction and the state. We think that this does send a message in terms of where the fiscal constraints really are right now with some local governments, in that they do not want to be required to do something that they don't have the funding to do, and in particular, if that is a priority of their community. So our interpretation of this bill, frankly, is that it doesn't change the way that we do things now.
Thank you.
Bill, do you have some testimony you want to give?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and would like to make about 4 points quickly, if I might, Mr. Chair. AOC believes that jurisdictional transfers should be made only when there is mutual agreement among parties, whether it's ODOT to cities or counties to cities. We have a clear statutory provision that exists now between transfers between counties and cities, and those jurisdictional transfers can only occur when both parties agree. Either party can initiate the discussion, but in the end, it takes mutual understanding of the situation, both parties' needs, and working those details out in accomplishing the transfer. As you certainly know, an ODOT district highway that is transferred to a city or county could be devastating to their budget if it's transferred without critical improvements that need to be made. What is a low priority on the state system immediately becomes a high priority on the county or the city system. I don't think we've had particular problems with those transfers being made where there hasn't been an agreement worked out, and generally there have been improvements made that reduce the immediate impact on either the city or county. That's key. The other key factor in doing these requiring some contribution and jurisdictional transfer is taking into consideration the varying resources that counties and cities have. Some counties may have the ability to, or cities may have the ability to participate to a greater degree, and those things need to be worked out on a case-by-case basis in some kind of a mutual agreement. In the end, I think that, as has been said by the other two witnesses, basically our problem is a lack of resources, where we have only $1 for every $3 to $4 of needs. This becomes a major problem of who handles those needs that aren't being met by the current funding system. So hopefully this is a introduction or a preliminary discussion to some kind of funding proposal that we could work together and get passed in this fashion and hopefully address some of these problems. Make it easier for us to come together and mutually agree on these transfers.
I got the message, Bill.
I have to take every chance we can.
Can I follow up on Representative Byers' question? Was that a yes or no, Andrea? And Bill, can you give me a yes or no? Do you like the bill or not?
Yes, we like the bill. We think it should be by mutual agreement.
And yes, the same is true. It has to come down to the agreement between the jurisdictions.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you, folks, for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we need a physical on this, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3510. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2749. And we have Representative Miller here this morning.
Here we go. License by sale. Oops. They can pay your company.
Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Randy Miller, District 37. I appreciate very much your willingness to hear this bill. Yesterday I presented...
Representative Miller, we'd like to bring some excitement in our life. Transportation is pretty low.
Yesterday I was before the Revenue Committee with a bill that attacked many of the tax credits that now reside in our tax laws, and it generated quite a crowd down there too, so I appreciate apparently, but I appreciate your hearing this bill. I want to tell you that in spite of what many people believe, there is no provision in House Bill 2749 that prohibits service, none whatsoever. So to the extent that the marketplace would require a demand service, it will exist. And there are provisions in this bill that do require service for certain categories of individuals, many of whom will apparently come forward today not having read the bill or understood the bill, but who will be served nonetheless if they so desire. those categories would be anyone who is 55 years or over, someone who has one of those blue placards on their car for disabled parking, or someone who has a medical condition that makes it dangerous or difficult for them to fuel their own vehicle. They are entitled under the provisions of this bill to receive service and would pay the self-serve price. So I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that if the members who are about probably to come up and object to this bill read its provisions, they would be here in support of this measure, knowing that they would get the same service they get today and pay less. So let me just say a few of the background pieces, because there's, as you know, there's been a lot of discussion about this, a lot of misinformation, a lot of misunderstanding. One of the things I would tell you is that the ban on self-service was instituted by the legislature in 1951. People will tell you that, you know, time and again, Oregonians have said no to this idea. I will grant you that in 1982, the people rejected this idea. It's my thought, in my experience in this process, that from time to time, sometimes 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, people have a different opinion based on information they receive. They change their minds. I don't think it would be out of bounds here to ask the people of Oregon for their view on this idea once again. And the demand for self-serve has actually been growing in this state. In 1999, a tremendous breakthrough. We allowed pilots to fuel their planes. Can you imagine that? We trusted them with that activity, and now they do it. I haven't heard of too many planes getting torched on the runways. In 2001, and I was proud to be a part of this, we allowed that great privilege to motorcyclists to fuel their own motorcycles. Now, of course, this could only be done after the highly trained technician passed off the pump to that motorcyclist, but they were indeed allowed the opportunity to stick it into that pump, fuel it, and then leave the station. What freedom. And as you know, we also expanded the card lock opportunity for individuals in the state by reducing the number of gallons required to qualify as a commercial account. And again, I've heard no negative situation propping up because of that. I'm not aware of card lock stations being, again, torched, blown up, huge fires, great carnage. So I think it's an activity, as you know, Mr. Chairman, that I believe this in my heart, that Oregonians are actually competent enough to fuel their own vehicle. I believe that. I think those who have traveled out of state and have come face-to-face with a pump and given the opportunity to fuel their own vehicle, once they have read those detailed instructions and figured out how to insert that credit card, have managed to do it successfully, felt liberated by the process. And I want that kind of freedom to be expanded to our state. Why, you ask, can't Oregonians do it? Why are we so incompetent? Well, let me help you. And this is one of the great provisions of our ORS. And I know that we're bound by this, and everything in here we have great respect for. However, ORS 480.315 is the policy that was adopted by this assembly dealing with the prohibition and the reasons therefore. And I just want to quote to you some of those reasons for this prohibition. In ORS 480.315, subsection 3, it suggests that if we allowed self-service in Oregon, now think about this, it would increase the crime rate. You're wondering why. And I've wondered why for probably 10, 15 years, ever since I've begun to challenge this idea. The only thing I can think of is that this particular policy statement was adopted back in those days when we used to have to go into the AM, PM, and you'd walk into the station or into the market part, and you'd say, I'm pump number 7. And you'd look at the numbers going up there, and you'd wait, you know, and you'd buy your pack of cigarettes or whatever you were in there for, or a candy bar, gum. They loved the situation. And it was at that time when you were in the store, you'd left your vehicle unattended, that those bad guys hiding behind the propane tanks rushed over to your vehicle, ripped out the stereo, took your wallet, your kids, whatever, and that increased the crime rate. I can't think of any other situation, you know, that would do it, but I guess that was the theory behind that particular addition to our fabulous statutes in this area. And allowing self-service would increase the number of injuries in this state because of the risk of personal injury resulting from slipping on slick surfaces. Huh? Because, as you know, most people, before they're able to insert the pump into the tank, into the vehicle, typically try to put gas all over the island area so that people are skating, and it's like Tonya Harding. I mean, they're just going everywhere, right? You know, so it's an exceedingly dangerous situation. I don't know why we haven't had more reports from other states about the tragic circumstances surrounding self-service, but, you know, that's the way it goes. I guess the information stream just kind of stops at our borders. This is fabulous, too. Subsection 4 suggests that this situation of this danger with people slipping all over the place, is enhanced in Oregon. You're going to love this on a day like this. It's enhanced because Oregon's weather, now I'm reading from the statute here, is uniquely adverse. Think about that. Uniquely adverse compared to what? Alaska? Montana? Minnesota? North Dakota? Maine? New Hampshire? Colorado? You know, we got it tough here. You know, you get out, you're going to be blown away. You're certainly going to fall out of your vehicle, and you'll just be blown away by all these uniquely adverse conditions we have. Another one that's kind of fascinating, Mr. Chairman, is that it suggests that if we went to self-service, that it would, the increased use of self-service at retail in other states has contributed to diminishing the availability of automotive repair facilities at gas stations. To which I say, so what? What has happened since really service left the gas station arena some time ago? What do we do? Anybody go to Jiffy Lube? Oil Can Henry? Are we still able to get our car served in a lot less time than we used to? I mean, when I took it into ordinary service stations many years ago, it was a half-day proposition in many cases. You know, it was like almost taking it to a dealership today. And you always got that feared phone call about that one other thing they found. But in any event, that policy statement is just, as you can imagine, I make a little fun of it, but it deserves to have a little fun poked at it because it's nonsensical. It doesn't belong in our statutes, nonetheless, and it should not serve as a prohibition to allowing people to serve themselves. I repeat, Mr. Chairman, this bill does not prohibit service. And I was thinking this morning, with Representative Greenlake, I said, where do you buy tires? And I'm not trying to suck up to you, Mr. Chairman, but we said
it'll help.
Very good. All right, I admit it, I am trying to suck up to you. Mr. Chairman, we both happen to say Les Schwab. And you know why that is? It's not necessarily the great prices you offer. But a very important component is service. And you do it. You know they're out there, running out there to greet you when you come in. To the extent somebody in the private marketplace serve people like that, my guess is they'd go there. Why do we fear that the market will respond to a demand of service? I think it would.
I understand it's not necessarily true in the coast.
Not necessarily. Yeah. North Coast? So, the other thing I'd like you to ask the subsequent witnesses when they come here is tell me, what is the state's compelling interest in prohibiting service, or in prohibiting people from serving themselves at a gas pump? What's the reason the state's involved here? Why do we make the fire marshal monitor this activity? You know, don't they have something perhaps useful to do? We're not preventing anything. And I would suggest it's a monumental waste of their time. And in the budget environment we're in today, I would suggest they wouldn't want this duty. And we're looking at their budget. And Mr. Chairman, I would suggest, too, you will hear from some that this is a jobs bill. That to the extent that we don't mandate this particular requirement, people will lose jobs. Well, let me pose it to you this way. Since it is, if it is a jobs bill, what if I came here before this august committee and I said, I have an idea for jobs here in Oregon. I have an idea that we should require that whenever you go to the Costco, to the Safeway, to the Fred Meyer, that you be greeted there at the doorway by an attendant who is required to push your cart. Think about that. What are you going to say? Oh, you're nuts. That's crazy. People can push their own cart. Yes, they can. And they should be allowed to do that. And can they fuel their vehicle? Yes, they can. And they should be allowed to do that. Cost. Some people say they have this anecdotal evidence. Well, you don't save any money by doing this. To which I say, gas pricing is a whole different subject. The big oil companies and their zone pricing, which I am no fan of, believe me, defies logic in many cases. Why is it many of us find gas here in Salem to be cheaper than when we go back, in my case, to Westland and Portland? Well, I think it's because the big oil companies have sold it in their particular pricing scheme based on demographics and based on who can afford what, in their opinion. It doesn't have anything to do, in great part, with the price of getting that product here, because to offload gas from Portland to bring it to Salem's got to cost more than it does to deliver it to West Lynn, I would suggest. Now, the AAA will come up here, and they're going to beef about this, but, you know, the problem with the AAA is we went to their website, and we did get some cost figures. It was nice of them to provide it for us. And the comparison they offer is Portland and Vancouver, where Vancouver just by chance happens to offer self-service. And for the last four comparisons they offer, gas in Vancouver averaged currently 6 cents cheaper. April 1, 2003, 6 cents cheaper. A month ago, it was 11 cents cheaper. A year ago, it was 11 cents cheaper. So let the AAA, who supposedly represents drivers, come up here and advocate that we pay a higher price. Isn't that special? So I hope they do that. And, Mr. Chairman, let me just tell you one other thing. The only way you can suggest that this doesn't have a cost impact is to suggest that labor costs nothing. What product or service can you deliver that requires a component of labor doesn't therefore add cost? And to the extent we add cost in the delivery of fuel to a motor vehicle, it adds cost. There's just no way around that. So I thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman, and please inquire with the following witnesses. One, have they read the bill? Are they offended by being in one of the protected classes that receives service and pays the cheaper price? Two, do they believe that labor is free? And three, why don't they allow me to fuel my own vehicle? What is it, and I mean this in a collective sense, what do they find about me and others that we are so incompetent that we just can't possibly safely fuel our own vehicle? I thank you very much for your time. Be glad to take any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And happy Friday to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Thank you, Representative Miller, for that incredibly heartfelt and entertaining testimony. I have to wipe the tears away from my eyes from the last part. But
well, that's good.
In your opinion, I'm just trying to, based on the last part of your testimony, figure out, in your opinion, do you believe if we go to self-serve that gas prices will go down in the state?
I think, again, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bingfelder, to the extent that labor is part of the pricing at an individual station, the savings to that station, in my judgment, would be passed on to the consumer. As I'm sure you know, that business is extremely competitive. A lot of us are not necessarily tied into whether or not we get Chevron with Techron or Shell with, I don't know what other additive they've got, but something special. But most of us say, you know, I need this octane level, and where's the price I can get it for at the cheapest? And I think the dealers who will testify here are extremely sensitive to that.
Mr. Chair, so was that a yes, Representative?
Well, I think it would be. To the extent they can save money in the delivery of their product, they realize their competitor would also save it, and they need to compete in the marketplace, again, because we are not tied into one. We're not tied into a brand. We'll go where we can get the best deal. And, I mean, we've all seen the gas price wars. You know, when they can drive down their costs, sometimes you know, it's hurtful to dealers to do that, but they have to survive.
Thank you.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Miller. If, in your mind, the citizens are ready for this, they're wanting to go there, why not a referral?
If this committee, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beyer, if this committee decided to refer this bill, that would be fine with me. I think, you know, again, because the bill continues to provide service for many of those who will come up here and moan that they're not going to get it, apparently, again, not reading the bill, understanding also that the American for Disabilities Act covers many people federally, you know, I'm confident they would still experience service and, in fact, as I said, pay a lower price. So I, as a legislative matter, I'm not afraid just to impose that. But if this committee was more comfortable referring it, I don't have a problem with that either.
Thank you. I represent his honor.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy, I don't know what you had for breakfast, but, God, you're at the top of your game. A year ago last September, my wife and I rented a car, and we traveled 8,800 miles over the United States, 28 states, and the pumps that they have at those gas stations are remarkable. You punch in your card, it says, good morning, where are you headed, east, west, or whatever. You punch a button, and they'll give you directions. You can order food and everything. But on September 11th, I was in Springfield, Ohio, when the terrorists hit the towers. And they shut off the pipeline. And that night, as I'm sitting out by the motel with my feet up having a beer, the gas prices went up to $5 a gallon. And there were fights in the service stations. There were little people
fighting.
You can imagine. I could stand up and show you. But if you can imagine the fight between her and me to get that gas nozzle, they were backing in every way they could.
Underestimate me, Representative. I'm scrappy.
That was a real. I'm sitting there and I'm saying, God, this could happen if we had another gas shortage like we had years and years ago. You know, people could start taking advantage of old people, little people. I know it's a macho thing for you to want to pump your own gas. I got that feeling also. But that one part we don't often talk about, and that can clearly happen whenever we have a shortage, because then the people can back in or drive in any way they want. They can grab another hose from somebody. You know, they don't have that attendant that requires them to do that. And that's one of my concerns in all seriousness.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, I appreciate that observation. That will add to the lore of this bill. In fact, that may be an explanation for the increased crime rates that I alluded to earlier, that I thought were just those guys behind the propane tanks. If you want to specify in the bill that fighting at the tank is prohibited, we could do that. But I think existing criminal law covers that situation.
I would suggest that maybe, you know, there's a Senate bill dealing with terrorism that would probably cover this.
Yeah, Senator Menes is on to that one.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenland.
Yeah, you need to help me on this one, Representative. We've already talked about it. I'm very much interested in domestic tranquility, particularly in my own household. And my most important constituent is violently opposed to this bill. Well, I'm in favor of it. And I wonder if you have any suggestions on how, I guess in seriousness, there is a gender gap in this. And I wonder what I can say to my boss when I go back to the office and say, you know, I voted for Representative Miller's bill. Do I get to come home with you tonight? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, I think you're right. The polling that I've seen, and it's I don't know how recent it is, but does suggest you're right about a gender gap. What I can tell you from my own experience in seeking and I'd say mostly achieving domestic tranquility over the last 25 years is I've told a lot of people that I used to just rinse the dishes at home, and now I load. What I would suggest is that until your wife qualifies for one of the categories, and hopefully it's just the age category, that you, being a wonderful husband, would see to it that the automobile that she drives is fueled at all times. And then I would guess that you won't have any problems.
Sir, I do want to state for the record that I would not acknowledge she is old enough to qualify for the defense.
I did not.
Mr. Chair, we got to follow up on that one.
I'm going to take it.
Better not be in trouble.
And if she wasn't, that number is flexible. Representative Greenlee.
I have another
question. It's up to the committee.
How flexible?
I may have had a question, but watching you carve Z's on these guys' desk, they all went away.
I do have one follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
I do need to ask you, are you doing this while you qualify for the senior exam?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, unfortunately, I do qualify, so you could suggest it's a very self-serving bill. But
Mr. Chair, but that's a tough one to follow. But I do have a question regarding line 8 in the bill.
Line 8?
Which says eligible customer, meaning an individual is 55 years or older, uh-huh. 55 years of age or older. So how is that determination made? In other words, that means I'm going to, or we would be, say I'd pull up. And I will tell you, I am under 55, mm-hmm. quite a few years. But how would somebody make that determination? It's going to be based on appearance. It's going to be somewhat subjective. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how we would decide if somebody fits into that senior category.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dinkfelder, typically when you drive your automobile, you carry your license. We hope you do. And your license, the one I carry, has my birth date on it. And to the extent someone wanted to challenge you when you demanded service or didn't qualify for service, I suppose they could check your license, your driver's license. So it's conveniently with you.
Follow-up.
Follow-up.
I understand that. And, of course, I always do carry my driver's license as well. However, and I know you weren't challenging that. However, that would mean, unless it was obvious the age of the person, I'm just trying to work mm-hmm. through this scenario. Somebody sitting in their car waiting for service. They don't get it. They have to get out. They have to go request it. And then they say, we'd like to see your license. And I guess that just seems like it puts a somewhat onerous responsibility on the gas stations to have to figure out who's eligible and who isn't. And it would mean they'd, for some, and there's, I think there's going to be quite a few people who look younger than their actual 55 years. Of course, most of the committee members here fall into that category. But seriously, how that would add another step, and I think would slow down service for those who are going to be requiring an attendant.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, I'm 56. I wasn't anxious to be 55, which is the threshold for a lot of special considerations, including the soft food at Denny's. It's not something you go out and proclaim with pride that you've reached that threshold, that you get these special things. So I guess in our interpersonal relationships with people, if we have to ask those sensitive questions, do you qualify for this service at the reduced price, I suppose you'd present evidence of that qualification. I remember going to, it was kind of sad, actually, I went to a movie theater right after I turned 55 and saw the qualifications for the seniors and children. And doggone if that teenager behind the glass didn't even ask me to produce evidence. She probably thought I'd been 55 for a long time, and I got in for the discount price. So I think we can handle that. If it's somebody who's trying to demand a service they're not qualified for and a dealer understands that, my guess is they ask them to show a license. But I just don't see that as a widespread problem.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Representative Beyer.
Follow up on that. Thank you. There again, you might run into a gender issue. Speaking as a person who happened to go up to a counter and be asked if she was, if she wanted the senior discount, and not being eligible. I mean, you know, that's another place in minefield you could step into with the.
You're walking on thin ice here, Representative.
Yeah. They've already destroyed you by asking the question. You may as well make it.
Or you don't go back to that particular retail establishment until they get their sensitivity training.
Is there any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Let's see. Can we have Paul Romaine and Cliff Olson, please? Gentlemen, you have a tough act to follow.
It's that old Bible saying, it's always hard to follow an animal act.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. With me is Cliff Olson from the Mark Nelson Oil Products Company here in Salem. We are in favor of the bill, and we just want to give you a little bit of information. Usually I try and make my testimony somewhat humorous. Following Representative Miller, it's near impossible, but we'll kind of see where it all goes. Just some basic things. First of all, on safety. The last time a gas station fire, there was a blow-up, basically, of a station. I'm intimately familiar with that because my wife did it. It was the summer of 1983. She was not my wife then. She was driving to have dinner with me on McAdam. She stopped at a station on McAdam to fill up the car. She was late. I couldn't understand why she was late for this wonderful meal I was cooking. And then I heard sirens, and then I got a phone call saying, can you come down to this station because I think I just set the thing on fire. And what had happened was that she pulled into the station. This was an attended station. She pulled into the station. She had said, fill it up. The person took her, or filled up the tank, came over, told her what the price was, took her credit card, took the credit card back, because there's nothing on the machine back then, or on the pump, ran the card, came back to her, gave her the card, gave her the thing to sign. She signed it, said, thank you very much, started the car, and drove off. The highly trained service station attendant had forgotten to take the hose nozzle out of the car. Pulled over the, at that point, didn't have breakaway hoses. Pulled over, sparked. She's driving away. I'm starting to laugh about it now because it was actually quite funny the way she was describing it. Driving away, dragging this pump, and there's like sparks, and they shut it off, but they basically the fire department had to foam the thing. The station was never operated again. Next thing you know, the station's being dug up. But the bottom line is, this is not a safety issue. What it is in 1951, the Oregon Gasoline Dealers Association were attempting to shut off competition from the major chains that were coming in. The independents didn't want the competition. The way you keep the competition out is by making sure that they have high costs if they can't come in and do self-service. That's why you have self-service. It's been on the books for a long time. It's become the cult of self-service now. I'm very familiar with fairly controversial issues, having gotten involved in many of them over the course of literally this week. But it literally is a cult in this state. There's a lot of urban myths out there about what self-service and non-self-service does. Gasoline's kind of a weird commodity. It's sold, different states, different regions have different kinds of gas that you buy, so you can't really compare apples with apples. It's very difficult to compare. There's different tax that goes into the various gas. Washington State has a 23-cent gas tax. Oregon has a 24-cent gas tax. Multnomah County adds 3 cents to the gas tax. Washington State has a B&O tax and a hazardous waste fee that goes into theirs. So it's very difficult to kind of try and compare apples with apples. So what we do is look at what Representative Miller looked at, which AAA looks at. That's where they get their statistics. It's the Oil Price Information Service, OPIS. They basically do a weekly survey. You can get it on the web. Weekly survey of gas prices. And Representative Miller was very correct. During 2001-2002, the last 2 years, the price difference between Vancouver and Portland was about 7.5 cents per gallon, Vancouver being cheaper. Our estimates, and you'll hear testimony later from some others, is you would save between 3 and 7 cents per gallon with self-service. Now, you can't compare an individual station with another individual station. People say we go to California, they have higher price gas than we do, or their gas formulation is totally different than ours. Prices are totally different. It depends what you buy it for, what the base is. Everybody has, within reason, about the same cost factor in there. To break even, most stations need at least 15 cents above what they paid for the gas to cover labor, everything else out there. You have different amounts of rent costs depending on where your station is. There are, as anybody in business knows, you have varying costs depending on where you are. So it's really hard to compare. But overall, OPIS says about a 7.5 cents difference. We're not talking card lock here. Card lock is a different animal. Card lock is a no service. There's nobody there. There's no attendant around. There's nobody to shut off anything. It's a separate issue. All we're talking about is does the consumer have the ability, in effect, to get out and pump the gas? And the way the bill is presented to you today, it has a senior service level. It has a handicapped service level. Personally, I would like to see the senior service level raised a little bit. I just turned 56 yesterday and do not consider myself to be a true senior citizen, although I will accept discounts at movies. I think that comes from an old time. I think basically senior really is about 65 at this point. So for none of you are that age yet, so you're okay. I do want to mention a couple of things. Polling. We just finished a poll. It came back today. I just got the final results literally this morning. It was a 500-sample poll of Oregonians done by the Nelson, it's Mark Nelson's company. It's Nelson Report, I think is what he calls it. The numbers are as follows. It actually tracks AAA very well. Today, if you simply say, Are you for or against self-service? 41% of Oregonians say yes, they're in favor of it. 51% say they're opposed to it, and 8% are not sure. It's heavily skewed where men are in favor of it, 52-43, and women are opposed, 31-59. Now, if you then ask the question about the bill in front of you, which is if you are required to have a person to assist, we put in elderly and handicapped. That's how we did it. Very simple. The numbers totally shift. With attended self-serve, which is in front of you today, the pro in favor 59, opposed 36, not sure 5. And where you see the dramatic shift is women. All of a sudden women go with the initial bill of 31 in favor to 58 in favor.
Mr. Chair.
You also see it with age group. Obviously, if you're over 65, you start thinking, well, I have service available. What I'm trying to tell you is what you have in front of you is not a no-service bill. It's a step to get Oregonians introduced to the concept of actually going out there and doing the technical work of putting the nozzle into their own car, not waiting. So the numbers are totally different. The other thing, which is very interesting, is when you ask, if you knew that self-service would cut the price of a gallon of gas by 5 cents, which is a number we used because our figures show between 3 and 7 cents, depending on the level of service, it switches from 41 in favor, 51 opposed, to 49 in favor, 44 opposed. The Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association for years opposed self-service. We were for years in line with the gasoline dealers and others. We opposed self-service. But it's getting to the point now where everybody is looking for any way possible to cut the cost of delivering the fuel. We're at the final end. We're the ones who either own the service stations or we're the jobbers who supply the service stations. We have a combination within our group. And everybody is trying to figure out a way to deliver this essential commodity to the consumer at less price. That's what the consumer wants. So we're trying to get there. That's one of the reasons why we shifted our stand, and we are now in favor of self-service. So we would appreciate your support. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Cliff, I don't know if you have anything you want to add or subtract from the testimony.
Glad to answer any questions.
But we would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. I represent his honor.
Paul, do you have the exact wording of the questions you asked in
the
polls?
I do. You want the exact wording?
Yeah,
give you the exact
on the second
wording.
And third one.
We did not ask, when did you stop beating your wife question.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Paul, would it be possible just to get a copy? I don't know if that's something that... Or a copy of the results.
Mr. Chair, yeah, Representative Dingfelder, I'd be more than happy to. Again, I just got the raw data here, but I'll give you the exact questions that were asked that I just referred to.
Okay.
There are other questions in here that relate to other issues that I will excise from the, and most of them are not gasoline-related issues. But let's see. If an election were held today, would you favor or oppose self-service gasoline stations in the state of Oregon? That was the initial question. That was one that was the 51-41. Oppose 51. If you knew self-service gas stations would cut the price of gasoline by approximately 5 cents per gallon, would you favor or oppose the proposal? And that shifted it to favorable 49, oppose 44. Yeah, 44. The other question, if you knew self-service stations were required to have a person present to assist seniors and handicapped persons, would you favor or oppose the proposal? And that's when it shifted dramatically to 59 in favor, 36 opposed, 5 not sure. So those are the three questions. I'd be happy to give that to you. Now, Representative Greenlick did have a very interesting comment of how do you deal with the other part of your family that might not be in favor of this particular bill. I, too, have been subject to that very dilemma. And as one somebody once told me, dealing with a question regarding the Middle East, how do I explain something? And they said, as best you can. It is what you find in this state is self-service and a couple of other issues. There's really three issues in this state that have sort of achieved a cult status where you really don't have a lot of rational discussion about it on either side, for or against. And unfortunately, I think seem to be involved in at least two of them. I'm trying to figure out how I get a client for the third one, but it's very interesting. It's an interesting dilemma. And basically what people are going to have to understand is over time, you will get used to it, and it's not that big of a deal. But, you know, I, too, will be filling my wife's gas tank for quite a while. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Could I add, Chair Brown, could I add one thing?
Certainly.
I think it was alluded to earlier, and I wanted to bring it up, and I kind of let it out here. But I think that if you even consider this a safety issue at all, you have to consider the fact that technology has changed dramatically since the policy that was alluded to earlier was put into effect. No longer are the pumps need manual setting. There's now breakaways involved, so that if there is the issue that Paul was talking about, they immediately disconnect and stop the flow of fuel. There's the credit card readers at the pumps, which were not available at the time that policy was put in. So it's just like computers or anything else. We have come so far since that policy was written that it really becomes absolutely obsolete when you look at today's technology.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for your testimony. Now we need to hear the other side. Larry Campbell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Larry Campbell, and I'd like to split my testimony into two parts. One, as a citizen who has had a great deal of responsibility and has had an opportunity to work with Representative Miller over the years. And I'd like to make a couple of comments that I think are probably appropriate. Just think of what you'd have missed today if this bill had passed last session. And my suggestion is that we take a look at bringing him back for an encore in two years. By the way, I want to mention Representative Greenlick mentioned his better half, and my better half has a similar view of this particular issue. And we were at a gathering, I'm sure Representative Miller wouldn't mind me mentioning this, where she personally took him on. Of course, he's not married to her, so it didn't have any influence. However, she did suggest then to him that he go over, and it was a reception, and have a drink at a full-service bar, which he did. You know, it was interesting to watch Representative Miller, because he pointed out to you that first we gave the opportunity to airplanes. Then we moved to motorcycles. Then we moved to card lock. Now, does that remind you in any way of rinse to load? And that, of course, is where he's gone at home from rinse to load. But in essence, what's happened with this particular bill is we have moved it from one point to the next. And, you know, he did a good job of basically identifying what my client would say. And I want to go into that portion next. Except we don't look at it quite the way he's identified it. What we look at it as is the people of the state of Oregon, if they really believed what could be done is identified in this bill, wouldn't have as much of a problem with it. I don't know where you buy your gasoline. I'd suggest that each of you identify in your own mind where you go, how many people are there to help you today. I happen to buy my gasoline at a service station where they have two major islands. They have one person working the island. They have one person inside working the inside process, two people. But the question I have is, where do you save money if you're really going to give service to people who would like to have it, such as the women, our wives, mm-hmm. Representative Greenlick, such as senior citizens and the disabled? Talk about the savings. It's amazing how much money they talk about saving. 5 cents a gallon. But if you look at the volume that they're passing on today, is that really even a savings? I mean, right today in Salem, you can drive down the street and 2 blocks apart you can see a 10-cent difference in the gas price. Now, where are we going to get the savings? In essence, what I'm saying is that the people that listened and took the poll results that were given to them, the questions that were given to them by Paul's group, basically, if they believe that those things can really be done with this bill, then I can understand why they would change their view. Another thing I'd like to point out, that Representative Miller has really been interested in this bill for a long time. I'd also like to point out, though, that he is from a relatively safe legislative district. And I don't want to encourage any of you to think that this is a dangerous bill, because it certainly isn't from a safety standpoint. I'd like to have you just take a quick look at the poll results that we gave you. And we didn't do any push polling. We just simply asked a question, because we basically, and I will mention that I have read the bill, and basically we don't believe that the protections are there or can be given that are committed. But take a look at the gender. Strongly opposed. It isn't just opposed. Strongly opposed. Female, 53%. Male, 42%. And look at the age effects. And then take a look at the age versus the party registration. It was interesting to me that party registration, Republican, Democrat, and Independent, almost the same. Nobody likes this bill. So all we would suggest is that our folks believe that the people of the state of Oregon are the ones that you have to respond to, not the petroleum folks, not other representatives, but the people of the state of Oregon. And unless you can assure yourself that the things that they suggest to you about service still being available to your wife, Representative Greenlick, my wife, and the senior citizens and the people that are disabled, then this bill should remain where it's been for this many years. And thank you very much for allowing me to testify in front of this august committee.
Thank you. Questions? No questions. Thank you again.
You bet.
Could I have Howard Nissner, please? Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. It gives me great pleasure to be here to discuss this important bill with us. And before I read through my testimony here, I just have to say a couple of things. It's hard for me to fathom the amount of hours and money that we, as citizens of this country, you folks, as representatives and legislators, as our businesses have all trashed thousands and thousands of dollars in time and energy over a ridiculous thing of whether we can pump gas or not. It just blows me away.
Excuse me just a minute, Mr. Messner. Could I ask you to identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry.
And then that,
yes,
then
Mr. Chairman. My name is Howard Meisner. I'm operations manager for Grange Co-op in Central Point, Oregon. And I'm up here in support of House Bill 2749.
Thank you.
We operate 3 card locks in Southern Oregon and have been doing so since 1976. Card locks, as you know, are very much like self-service. A customer drives into a card lock, enters their card, some security numbers, selects a particular dispenser, and pumps their gasoline. When the customer has finished fueling their vehicle, they hang up the nozzle, the fueling process is completed. All of these transactions were actually completed without an attendant. Presently, this is as close to self-service as we can get in Oregon. This type of self-service is only available to qualified commercial customers who pay a yearly fee and provide documentation to qualify. The Oregon State Fire Marshal subjects these customers to yearly audits and approval. card lock sites are completely unattended. There are several hundred of these unattended fueling sites in Oregon. All of these years dispensing gasoline in Oregon, there has not been a serious accident or injury due to self-service gasoline through a card lock. Card locks have been a testing platform. Now the proof is in. Safety is not the issue in dispensing of gasoline. It's all about a few people wanting some degree of service for free. The truth is that gasoline stations cannot afford to give this service and remain a viable business. The cost of operation is becoming too expensive, and some changes must be made as we want to have a place to purchase gasoline in the future. This is leading us to a point that we should unanimously support House Bill 2749 that will bring self-service to Oregon, just as we have in 48 other states in this union. The public should be allowed to dispense their fuel, and the state should not be mandating who can and who cannot dispense gasoline. A small percentage of people in Oregon feel that they have the right to be served or should be waited on. House Bill 2749, as written, has this provision for an attendant for the few that want or need the service. A very large number of people in Oregon want to pump their own gasoline and move on, not having to wait for an attendant. They don't want to sit and wait while someone puts a nozzle in their tank and walks off to do something else, coming back sometime after the nozzle is shut off. The act of dispensing gasoline is looked upon as though you must have an extensive schooling to undertake this task. The prohibition of gasoline sales in Oregon by the state makes the assumption that the majority of the Oregonians are not intelligent enough to dispense gasoline. Well, the truth is, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do it. Just use some common sense, and we have that. I sincerely urge you to get behind this Senate Bill 2749 and give it your full support. We need self-service in this state.
Thank you, sir. Any questions?
Representative Byer.
Thank you. You have a statement in here that said it's all about a few people wanting some degree of service for free, but yet we've listened to testimony from the industry saying that there is a cost for this service, and that by changing this, we will be reducing our cost for gas. So I'm trying to get the statements together and figure out whether we really are saving or not.
Chairman, Representative Bowers, I fully believe that going to self-service could possibly pass on some savings. That amount of savings is very nebulous, if there is a savings at all. I wouldn't build my castle on the savings. I would build my castle on the fact that down the road we will still have a place to buy gasoline, because the cost of operation for service stations throughout the state is becoming immense. We're increasing the minimum wage laws. The insurance of operating a service station is getting out of sight. The taxes being imposed, and the margin that is being allowed on fuel is becoming very narrow. Service stations, to remain in business, have got to do something to increase their bottom line. Part of that is to change your labor picture, your overhead expenses. By going to self-service, by passing that law, you're going to allow stations to remain in business for several years down the road. It's getting very close for service stations now to remain in business.
Representative's honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At your card lock, what's your price for unleaded gas, regular unleaded, I guess you'd say, right now per gallon?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative's honor, that's a good question. And before I answer that, I want to give you a little example of the cost difference in operation between card locks and retail stations. Retail stations have the manpower, and they, you come in, you pump the gas, you pay for it at that time usually, and leave. In a card lock, you don't get paid at that time. It's down the road quite a ways. You've got a tremendous amount of accountability that you have to provide that is mandated by the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office. Plus, all card lock customers, the card lock operators have to pay a fee, a $5 per customer fee. You see, so we don't have a level playing field. But nonetheless, the cost of operation of a card lock is just about the same as a manned station. So your operation is about the same there. The price is very much the same. Our card lock price today is 2 cents under the retail stations that are right near us. 2 cents. Is that because we don't have an attendant? I couldn't tell you. Our price, we have zeroed in on where we want to be as a price, and that's where we have to be. Sometimes our margin gets cut down to just a very small amount, and sometimes we have a larger margin built in there. But the cost of operation for either one is just about the same. Consequently, the price is just about the same.
And what follow-up? Could I have a price on that? Is it?
Certainly. This is in Southern Oregon. It's $1.83.9, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony today. I appreciate you coming.
You came Thank you.
Some ways. Yeah. Thank you. Could I have Phyllis Rann and Lee Hazelwood, please?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Phyllis Rann, Governor's Commission on Senior Services and the Legislative Coordinator for the Commission. We're here to oppose House Bill, and we believe that there are a couple of issues. And one is, I want you all to know that I've read the bill. And
Carry the first question.
Yes, right. And not only have I read the bill, I also went back and read the ORSs.
Okay.
And there, I do not see any enforcement language in the bill. So, you know, if a owner decides that he doesn't want to provide that service, there's really nothing there that makes him do it. I think that the cost of fuel in other states that I've gone to where there's self-service gas, there wasn't any saving. I understand the fluctuation in prices, but we think that that it isn't going to be a money-saving piece for people. We also believe that there will be a lot of people out of work. And I know that Senator Miller believes that employment is not an issue in this bill, but we do hire people to serve gas. I have a personal story that is my only experience with pumping my own gas in the state of Washington. I'd never done it before. I pulled up into the station and, you know, just momentarily forgot that someone wasn't going to come out and serve my needs. And so when I finally realized that I was going to have to pump my own gas, I went in and I said, "So how do I do this? You know, I've never done this before. We don't do this in Oregon." You know? And so she explained the process, and then I filled up my tank and went back in and said, "Where's your bathroom so that I can wash my hands, please? They're all smelly." And she said, oh, well, I'm really sorry. This is a brand new station, and the owner decided to put in a car wash instead of a bathroom. So if you want to wash your hands, you can go across the street to the Dairy Queen restaurant and wash your hands over there. And I said, oh, yeah, you bet. So that was my only experience with self-service gas, and I personally didn't like that very well. So back to the commission. The commission is still opposed because we don't believe that, in fact, the people will get served. And, like, if there's only one pump and all these people are lined up at one pump because this is the only one where they will get service, I think that's going to be, there'll be a bottleneck there. But I also feel, or the commission also feels, that there's a gender piece that happens here. I don't know, we don't know of any woman on the governor's commission who wants to fill up their own gas tank. And it's not free. You pay for it. Customers pay for the service they get. And I'm willing to pay for that service. Thank you. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Please, why don't you go ahead and give your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood, a longtime senior advocate for seniors and people with disabilities. I've also been a longtime member of the Governor's Commission, but not at the present time. It was amazing to me in my lifetime. I have had the privilege of listening to Reverend Billy Graham a number of times. And as my eyes became glazed this morning listening to Representative Miller, the only thing I missed was, it's time to pass the collection plate.
You'll get that later.
And no reflection on Representative Miller, because I've talked to him a number of years about this present bill. He's getting very good because he's got the 55 years of age and over, and it's amazing that he became 56. But elderly people are, well, first of all, Oregon has one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. I happen to go to a service station, and he mentioned the word, so I'll use it again, Fred Meyer, because they give a discount. I'm a senior who pay my own way all the way through. But I've asked the people there, and the one I go to have three elderly men working there. And after you become acquainted with people, you have a tendency to ask them questions. And I said, why are you doing this? Well, my income has dropped dramatically, and I'm doing this to supplement my income so my wife and I can go out to eat once or twice a week. And that was amazing. So the last time I was there, there was a young fellow who filled my tank. And I guess because he saw my age, we got to talking while he was filling the pump, and I said, filling the tank, and I said, why are you doing this for a living? He said, no, I'm a college student at Willamette. I'm doing this in order to earn a little extra money that I can have some extra things while I'm going to college. It's very expensive. So I got up this morning, then I took a poll in my own house. And it was amazing to me that it was 2-0. Both of us, my wife and I, were opposed to self-service gas. But another part of this bill, what worries me, and having lived in the state of Michigan, where I believe that Representative Greenick lived for a number of years, there has been instances where mother with small children gets out, goes in, and say, I want my tank filled. Leaves a credit card there. They fill the tank. She comes back out. The car and the children are both gone. There have been a number of instances in Michigan where this has happened. Luckily, over a period of time, they have recovered the car and the children. This is a possibility with this bill. I guess I would also like to ask, would your wife, your mother, how they feel about this bill? I think that's where the survey should be. In the years that I was on the Governor's Commission, we carpooled to the state of Washington. But one of the ladies on the Governor's Commission had to drive her van so it was handicapped accessible for her wheelchair. As we were coming back from Washington, she stopped at a service station, and some of us stopped to double-check to see if she was okay. She said, yes, I just need gasoline for my van. So it's okay, we'll go on. No, she, maybe you better wait. So we waited over out of the way, and she sat there, and she sat there, and she sat there. No one came out to fill her tank. Lo and behold, about 15 minutes later, somebody pulled in behind her and sat and waited. And finally, he got out of the car and walked up to her and said, lady, are you having a problem? She explained the situation to him. He said, well, I'm from the state of Oregon, but I will fill your tank for you. And she thanked him very much. So I have read this bill. Very interesting conversations. You hear people testifying. ORS 480315 specifies this. It says this. Higher liability insurance rates charged to retail service stations reflects the dangers posed to customers when they leave their vehicles due to condensed glass 1 flammable liquids. I believe that a service station owner would need higher liability insurance. That adds the price of gasoline. So other than that, I guess my opinion would be that I'm violently opposed to this. But I have gotten permission to read this to you. It was given at Willamette University in January 23, 1994. A very likable lobbyist around the Capitol. And this is some of the things that he said. Nothing is as easy as it looks. Whatever hits the fan will not be evenly distributed. Those who profess to understand the problem tend to be furthest away from it. Nothing ever is done for the right reason. Nothing ever is so bad that it can't be made worse by passing a law. And thank you, and I'll be willing to answer any questions you have.
Any questions? Representative Greenland.
Yeah. Besides, who wrote that?
What was that? Wes Sullivan.
It was in Wes Sullivan's column, Fred Bonanna, and I asked him permission to use this because I, as you can see, it's kind of faded, but it struck me as that this gas bill might come up again. I thought, I'll save that at some time or other. This thing will come up again.
It's a plot. You really did raise an important point. You know, I've been with you on a lot of issues about the question of the way to enforce the requirement to provide service. Would you feel more comfortable with this bill if there was inserted a sanction of some reasonable sort to help enforce the service provisions? Would an amendment like that make you more comfortable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, I would be more comfortable if this bill just died a natural death.
Yeah, but I still have the same question.
I know I would not.
Thank you. Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What if we just increased the card lots that just were exclusively self-service, and then we had other stations that were just exclusively the way they are now. Would that
bother
you at all if they allowed it to do that and people can...
Mr. Chair, Representative Honor, I'm not sure if all the facts are known that if you count the extra insurance that people have to have, whether card locks are as cheap as people think they are. And I will add one other equation. In my lifetime, the company I work for, I travel quite a bit in different states. And probably my stupidity, but when I used to have to get out to fill my tank, the only time I ever spilled was when I was all dressed up. If I had my old jeans and my cowboy boots and stuff on, I never spilled it. But here I am going 300 miles for a meeting, and the first thing you know, I stop and fill my tank, and it gurgles back, and there I am going to a meeting with gasoline smell. And so that would
be
my...
In Eastern Oregon, blue jeans and boots, I was dressed up.
Well, maybe we... Mr. Chair, Representative, maybe we need boots because when we fill gas, it slops all over. So.
Thank you, folks, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate it. Could I have Brent DeHart, please?
Good morning.
Good morning, Brent.
My name is Brent DeHart. I am the president of the Oregon Gasoline Dealers Association. I will testify today representing the association. I am also a small dealer. I own a small business here in Salem as a gasoline retailer. The Oregon Gasoline Dealers, we represent the guys on the street, the retailers on the street that service Oregon's customers, the citizens, and its visitors. Our organization officially is neutral. We took that position in our fall annual meeting. The reason we have been neutral is in years past, our industry has been decidedly split. We had people who would sell their grandmother to get self-serve, and we get people who think it's the worst thing that could possibly happen to them. So for that reason, the association takes that position. However, we were charged in the fall with taking a renewed poll, given the increases in minimum wage and some of the other issues affecting our industry, including large box retailers and some card lock issues, to re-poll the membership. And I would report to you that our poll is similar in that it shows the same trend that the AAA polls trends show. And the OPMA trends show that our industry and the public sentiment is moving towards a favor of lifting the bans. Our poll came out, 2 out of 3 dealers who responded said that they would be in favor of lifting the ban. So the association is still neutral, but in years to come, perhaps they will not be so. The association feels very strongly on this issue of self-serve that it should be either legal or illegal in Oregon. In New Jersey, they don't have unattended card locks. We are faced with a situation in our state where self-serve is very legal. It's alive and well. And unfortunately, for the dealers who service the public and its visitors, it's only legal based on form of payment. I know there's been testimony regarding the motorcycles and the diesel trucks, diesel pickups, even if it's household use, is exempt from the ban. And, of course, country clubs and airports and motorcycles. But given the changes to the card lock restrictions in the last legislative session, we face a situation where if somebody wants self-serve and they drive in the course of their business, which many of us do, they can get it. Unfortunately, we are in a position as the retailers of not being able to compete for that dollar. I feel like there are many young people or maybe not so young, but there are a lot of people. It's a busy society we live in that want the service, not even talking about price when it comes to self-serve, but they want to be able to pull their car in, stick the hose in, stick it out, hang it up, go. And they're attracted to that card lock island with no lines. Now, if they go to the card locks and say, I drive in the course of my business, they can have self-serve. And the concern for our industry is that's a market segment that we can no longer compete for. And it's growing. So the people who are living busy lives and want to avoid the lines and can do it themselves and want to do it themselves are going to find the avenue to do so. And unfortunately, the public policy now gives that advantage to the unattended ghost stations of the card locks. So we don't have a, and we don't have a problem with card locks' existence. We're not at war with the card locks. I think they serve a very real market segment. We just feel that in Oregon, self-serve needs to be illegal or legal, and really somewhat indefensible in its current form. We would urge the legislature not to govern by anecdotal stories, but govern public policy based on ration. And I like the quote about whoever says they understand the problem is furthest away, or may not be as close to the problem. We are on the streets. We understand the problems very well. I also wanted to second the OPMA testimony that price comparisons really hold no validity whatsoever, especially in other states. You can't compare Salem prices. I know I'm paying decidedly different for my brand of gasoline than a guy a couple miles away is paying for another. Different states have different blends, competitive factors, taxation situations, and competitive situations. The real question you need to ask yourself if you want to compare prices or want to compare cost savings is, what is the margin you have to pay the dealer who pays the wages? And that is, my margins are invisible to you because you just look at my street price. But the difference between the price we pay and the price you pay us for it is our margin, how many pennies per gallon. The pennies per gallon in Oregon are 5 to 10 cents higher than the pennies per gallon in a dealer margin in a self-serve state. So I would disagree with the 3 to 7 assessment. I would think it'd be a little higher. I think it'd be 5 to 8 cents. But you are paying us dealers to pay for the labor. So if we had self-serve, would prices go plummeting down? Absolutely not. But would the dealer margin shrink to be in line with other competitive factors in self-service states? I believe they absolutely would and could save the consumer 5 to 8 cents. So again, and the other question to ask yourself, if you're going to compare the price in Boise, is what's going to happen to the price in Boise if we have self-serve? The answer is absolutely nothing. Our self-serve situation has nothing to do with the price in Boise or price on I-5 in California. It has nothing to do. If we have self-serve or no self-serve, their price will remain the same. It's what will happen to our dealer margins and our street prices. And if we're 5 cents cheaper now, should we be 10? And that concludes my testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions regarding the industry, regarding our organization.
Brent, you have multiple islands in your service station. Could you split that where part of it was self-serve and part of it was full service?
Yes.
Would that work?
I believe it would.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have a similar question. And is it feasible to do what this bill talks about and still save money at the dealer level, having self-service and providing service for the elderly and the handicapped? Is that a feasible thing for you as an operator, and would you still save money under that circumstances?
That's a good question. Representative, I think it largely depends on the kind of facility. We have many different ways to be a retailer in the state, and also many different types of facilities as far as how many islands, whether they have a kiosk, whether it's a store, and how they accept and what kind of form of payment they accept. So the types of savings they'll realize will largely depend on the setup of the station. At stations such as mine, where I have three islands and a kiosk, it's very feasible because you still have one person right there with the cars. In a situation where you have a distant store and you're going to have an attendant on the islands anyway, their savings might be a little bit less. But it's going to be, like I said, you're going to find examples where it probably won't save the operator, but you're going to find examples where it will save the operator quite a bit of money. And yes, I think it's feasible as an... if your question was about functioning in that retail environment.
Any other questions, Ray? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Can we have Howard Fisher, please?
Good morning.
Good morning,
Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Howard Fisher. I own a Chevron service station in West Lynn, Oregon, and I'm a second-generation dealer. My father opened up a Richfield service station in Oregon City in 1952. I worked for him for several years going through high school and college. 6 years ago, opened up the Chevron station there in West Lynn. I'm an independent dealer. I own one facility. I'm a little mom and pop. My wife and I, everything we have is tied up in our station, in the one corner. You know, there's several different types of dealers. There's jobbers who own multiple units. I'm just one of the little guys that has a mom and pop store, and the same as what my dad did. My two of my three kids work for me, and in hopes that we can continue to exist. The reason that I'm here, I have flip-flopped on this issue. My dad testified several times over the years. He was a president of Oregon Gasoline Dealers in opposition to self-serve. I grew up in opposition to self-serve. The reason has already been stated that we were in opposition to self-service to keep out the so-called big boxes, the Safeways, the Albertsons, the Costcos, the Walmarts. Well, that kept them out for a while, but now it's not the case. Now they're here. Now we have to, as an independent operator, I have to deal with that. So there's several different ways to do it. The reason that I'm here and the reason that I flipped on this issue as an operator is because I have to evaluate my cost and the ability to compete with that new competitor. I think competition is good, and it makes us sharpen our pencils and become better at what we do. And this is one of the ways that we can do that. I can tell you in my facility today that I could lower my price 8 cents a gallon, and I would say that's a minimum. It could be even a bit higher. Does that mean that I would sell my fuel? My fuel would cost less than the guy down the street? That's not what I'm saying at all, because I can tell you there's a service station exactly like mine 3 miles away on the same street that his purchase price is between 6 and 8 cents a gallon less than mine today. So that makes it so when you drive by, you look and you go, wait a minute, these are both Chevron stations. What is the deal? Let me try and quickly explain, which I believe a lot of you are aware. There's several different ways as a dealer to buy fuel. One is off of the rack. That's direct. And there's two different prices on the rack. One is branded and one is unbranded. Those are different prices. One is called VTW, which is dealer tank wagon. That's the way that I purchase fuel, and I purchase it directly from Chevron. Chevron has what was mentioned by Representative Miller, what's called zone pricing. Chevron will sell fuel to different dealers for different prices based upon their location. I'm not going to get into that issue. I can tell you that when you as a consumer, when you're looking at gas prices, it's very confusing. And it's confusing to me as a dealer. I can understand your position. All I can tell you is that self-serve will allow me as a dealer to sell fuel for less. With the competitors of the big boxes, the Safeways, the Albertsons, the Costcos, they sell fuel as a loss leader. They sell it at cost, which is a total another issue that hopefully that you will all take a look at also. But it allows me, when they're selling fuel at cost, I believe that they don't evaluate their labor cost as a line item issue. I do. I have to factor that into my sell price. What I believe self-serve will allow me to do as an independent operator is to be closer to their sell price than what I presently am. And I'm not sure whether that'll be 4 cents or 8 cents, but I know that I can get closer to their sell price. So what I have to look at doing is I need to get closer because everybody makes a conscious choice. Is 10 cents the number that I'm gonna drive down the street for? I'm gonna go wait in line for? Is 5 cents that number? I'm not sure. But as an independent operator, what I'm going to do, and the reason that I'm in favor of attended self-service is because I can still provide an attendant for you and your wives and the elderly, and I can train that attendant to be better than the attendant that you're gonna find at Costco or wherever else. I can train that attendant to wash your window. I can train him to check your oil. I can train him to be aware. As an operator, I'm going to want that attendant to make the evaluation that was mentioned earlier. Is the person over 55? No, not over 55. Basically, that's not what the way that I would want that attendant to do it. If I see, and what I would want my attendant to do is, if he sees a person sitting in their car and not getting out, I'm going to want him to go up and say, "Can I help you?" What I can, because I can do that as an independent, and because of the fact that I'm on site, I can provide that to where the big box can't. So I can differentiate myself from them even more. But the thing that I can't do right now is I can't get closer in price because I have fixed costs and I have to make a profit. So what attendant self-serve would allow me to do would allow me to get closer to that competitor and allow me to stay in business. At one point there was a time in growing up that each little town had its own little drugstore. You had your own pharmacist, like you had a family doctor. Now you buy your drugs at the pharmacist at Fred Meyer, Safeway, Costco, or wherever, and you know it's pretty generic. That local corner drugstore isn't there anymore. You drive by a lot of service stations that were independent service stations that are closed up. It's a reality. It's happened to friends of mine, and it will continue to happen. And I believe that this bill will allow my kids to be a third generation in this industry. It's been talked a lot about seniors and women not being opposed to this issue. I related a little bit to like the bag your own groceries, the Winco's, the Cub Foods. You go to those places and you see women and seniors bagging their own groceries so that they can save money because of the fact that the operators have reduced costs. I believe that this is the type of a situation that you would see in Oregon. I still, with attended self-serve, you would still having the attendant, you would differentiate us from other states. The other 48 states don't have the attendant that we would have. It's been talked about who would enforce the attendant. In checking up that I've done, I don't believe it would change. I think that the fire marshal just wouldn't have as big as, and that might be a question for Representative Miller or someone, but I believe that the fire marshals would still be responsible to find out that there's an attendant on duty, and if they get a report from someone that says, "Hey, I'm a disabled person and I went to this facility and could not get any service," I believe that should be checked out. So I believe there still would be some enforcement there, but the responsibility would be much less. The employment scenario has been addressed several times. I still would be an employer if I had attended self-serve. And if we don't get it, I question how long that would happen. I'm not going to be a doomsdayer and say that. I mean, I'm going to do whatever I can because, like I said, everything we have is there. But I would still be an employer. I would just be able to reduce my costs. It would not only reduce my cost in regular wages, especially given the fact of minimum wage going up and minimum wage being tied to the CPI. That's a real factor. I mean, those are real dollars. Those are real savings that we would be able to pass on. Insurance was mentioned. Because it's attendant self-serve, we would not have an insurance issue. There'd still be an attendant. We have the automatic breakaways. We have the emergency shutoffs. We have all the new technology on our facility that would be able to encounter those issues. I would also have lower workman's comp costs because I would have fewer attendants, would continue to lower my costs. So I'm here to testify to you today because it's important to our industry. Just a little more about me. I'm a past president of Oregon Gasoline Dealers. I'm a present board member on the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. I'm a member of both organizations. It's the first time in the history that I'm aware of ever that both organizations have done surveys and had an overwhelming result of dealers in favor of this bill. Both all the dealers in the state, by majority, are for the first time in favor of this bill. I appreciate your time. Be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for the representative's honor?
Yes, Mr. Chair. With Walmart and Safeway and Fred Meyers and those people on their own lots, if it was self-serve for everybody, they could still lower their gas prices if you tried to lower yours, because they can sell that at a loss to draw people into the grocery store. So it's kind of like comparing apples and oranges, wouldn't you think?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't believe so because of the fact that presently, now, this is not a factual statement, okay, this is an opinion. Presently, I don't believe that they line item their labor and compare their costs and their actual cost of pumping fuel. I believe that's lumped together as a store cost and evaluated that way. I've got no information that be the case. I believe that I can get closer. I could not sell fuel for the same price they do. So, but I believe that I could get closer to their sell cost. And so, from my viewpoint, I don't believe it's an apples to oranges comparison. I believe that we would get closer.
Representative Mabry.
Howard, good to see you again.
Mm-hmm. Good to see you.
In the Dalles, where I buy my fuel, basically, I choose to go to a service station because of service, that I pay, penny more or something more, because they clean the crud and bugs and what have you off my windshield every time. And I'm willing to pay the 15 or 16 or 18 cents for having that service done. So service does count.
Mm-hmm.
Having your clientele split, some are going to pump their own, some are not, and not knowing at any given time what clientele is going to come into your service station, does that present you any big problems in terms of scheduling or knowing how many, or is this just something that will evolve over a period?
I believe that as an independent operator, I'll have to adjust to what that is. I think that it will evolve. I don't believe that I would immediately go to one attendant. I believe that I would scale down over a period of time, over, you know, training the consumer. I'm going to probably allow the consumer to tell me, and I'll do that based upon how you know, good they're getting along with doing it, learning how to use the card readers. With the technology that we have today, I face a great deal of frustration with, especially when I'm not on the facility and I'm not 24/7, you know, an attendant off talking to a girlfriend, and I hear these stories all the time, a customer waiting for a long period of time. I'm going to be try to provide a better service than I believe that you'll be able to get at Walmart, and that's going to be the thing that's going to keep you coming to my station. And I'm going to do it through washing windows, checking oil, and doing some of those little things. And I'm going to do it by making that attendant more aware of your needs. But it is going to be a gradual thing. I don't see it from my perspective, and my facility is an immediate thing. The law passes, and right now I 90% of the time I had three attendants. We happen to be pretty busy, and I have three islands, and so I've got at least one person watching each island. After a little while of allowing the customer. Picture you go in and get out of your car, not waiting for anyone, put your card in it, put the gas nozzle in it, take the nozzle out, hang it up, take your card out, and you can go, and you don't have to wait for anybody or talk to anybody, or, you know, it's a that in itself is a service. And if having an attendant there come up and say, is there anything I can do for you, I think is even a bonus.
Thank you, Howard, for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Could I have Glenn Zirkle? In committee, there is a representative from the fire marshal's office here. If we've got any questions in that regard, we can have them. Good morning, Glenn.
And a good morning to you. Chairman Brown, members of the committee, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to address you. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Petroleum Marketers in favor of House Bill 2749 regarding self-serve in the state of Oregon. My name is Glenn Zirkle. I'm the president of Westco Petroleum. We have 60 company-operated stations located in Oregon, ranging from Ashland, Oregon, all the way on up through Washington to Blaine, Washington. I also wholesale supply another 97 individuals who own their own stations throughout both states as well. As a testimony in favor of this bill has explained, it is our desire that this bill would help level the economic playing field, not only for all Oregonians, but for our industry. Our recent new competition are the big box stores, which have been addressed. They're the likes of the Fred Meyers, the Costco, the Albertsons, the Safeways, the Walmarts. These competitors represent to us the mother of all David and Goliath battles. Some of these entities have more balance sheet strength than even those of the major oil companies. Certainly, Walmart represents a larger balance sheet strength than a number of the oil companies rolled up together. When big box pump the volumes of petroleum that they do at the prices that they sell it for, our segment of the industry, the dealers and distributors who reside in Oregon and provide services to the communities throughout Oregon, are in danger of no longer being able to compete and serve the public with competitive pricing. Self-serve in Oregon would bring a competitive capacity that will not match that of our wealthy competition, but it would bring us closer to be able to compete against them, and it does so by lowering our cost of operation. Specifically, our index labor cost here in Oregon runs between 3 and 7 cents per gallon, more than our cost to operate in the state of Washington under a self-serve environment. The larger a station is in Oregon, the larger the cost savings. Self-serve not only gives Oregonians the freedom to obtain their fueling needs with much faster service, but allows the dealers and distributors who serve them to provide the product at much lower costs. I think, as I've listened to the testimony here today, I remember back to when I first learned to drive. It was not a dissimilar discomfort to that of me learning how to use a computer. But I think it's disingenuous of our seniors here to hold that they cannot learn something new or cannot become comfortable with something that is new to them, like the other 240 million Americans in our nation, let alone the rest of the population of the world, which operates under self-serve. Representative Miller was accurate that there would be testimony this morning that addresses this issue, some of it from a basis of knowledge, some of it from a basis of emotion. The question has come up about that cost savings. My company in the two states, Oregon and Washington, where I operate, is pressing $200 million a year in revenues. I not only have the numbers, I have the economics to prove that there will be cost savings under a self-serve environment. There was also a question about what would happen if something happened with war breaking out or a shortage of product. The first act that President Reagan did in 1982 when he became president, in January of that year, the first bill he signed was a deregulation of the petroleum industry. If a commodity such as petroleum were to become that of a national security item that would endanger public safety, this industry would re-regulate itself in order to protect it. We've operated under regulations that limit how the fuel is sold and to whom it's sold to, and that would not be a difficulty for our industry. No, every industry is falling under additional cost, not only from state, from city, and local governments. I can't believe that there wouldn't be an element of support from you, as well as from the industry or from the public at large, that would allow an industry to be less burdened by the regulatory compliances that it's under. This bill allows men and women entrepreneurs in the state of Oregon to conduct their business with more efficiencies. And in turn, when we have more efficiencies, the lower cost of our product and our services gets out on the street to the consumer. The question about that 10-cent analogy on the street, you know, somebody's providing product a dime cheaper than somebody else. Typically, those are occurring at an ARCO station, and sometimes they're even happening at an Astro station, which is my chain, when I'm able to compete with ARCO. The savings comes when more stations have a lower cost of operation, and they're able to pass through, they're able to provide for the general public a unified number of entities or stations, fueling facilities, that everyone can buy at cheaper fuel costs because we have less cost of labor. I appreciate this opportunity to address you on this issue. I am encouraged that you are addressing, as Representative Miller noted, it was 1982 that this came before the voters of the state of Oregon and was defeated. It's certainly our desire that you would move this process forward through passage of this bill and allow it to have a chance again. Thank you. I'd be willing to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you again, Glenn, for your
time. Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee.
Janet has a couple letters to enter for the record.
They're probably on the bottom of your stack by now, but, Mr. Chair, two letters that Representative Miller received as emails to enter into the record, one from Dan Reed and one from Susan Freeman.
Thank you. And is there anyone else that wish to testify on this bill this morning? And then we will close it. Was there one? Okay, one more.
Sign up.
Yeah. We'll reopen House Bill 2749.
Thank you. I'll be brief. I'm not a member of any organization. My name is Deborah Brannigan. Like I said, I'm not a member of any organization. Don't belong to any clubs, groups. I just drive a lot. And I'm one of the female gender that you keep talking about. And I am for Representative Miller's House Bill. And I am a Washington resident. I own a house that's about 45 minutes north of Seattle. But I work at Freightliner, so it's a long commute. I have an apartment, which I reside in Monday through Friday, in downtown Portland. I go home to my house on the weekends. So I know every gas station along the I-5 corridor. I would say prior to coming out to Washington 6 years ago, I was a Detroit, Michigan resident and spent my whole life there, worked in the auto industry there, where we pump our own gas. There's virtually, who else was here from Michigan? As you know, the public transit there is none. So it's a lot of driving. Everybody does their own driving and pumps their own gas. When I moved here, I originally worked at Boeing, and when the layoffs came, came down a Freightliner and pulled into what was a BP at the time, got out pumping my gas, and this poor kid came running out. I'll do that. Oh, it's fine. You know, thanks. You're very nice. I'll do this myself. And he told me it's a $500 fine for you to do that. And I was floored. I thought it was a joke. I thought this was a joke. When I got to Freightliner, started my job, and began to ask some people, and they said, yes, it's for real. It's not a joke. Since then, I've looked up the ORS 418 on the website, 480-315, and went over what the reasonings behind it were. Great website you guys have, too. It was very easy to find. My own experience with the gas stations in downtown Portland, I can't speak for outside of it because weekends I'm up to Washington. The lineups are so bad that most of the people that work on Swan Island that I know of, if you need to get gas at lunch, we go to Vancouver. I don't remember the last time I got gas in Oregon. I make a point to wait until I'm across the border. There's been a lot of talk today about the pricing and the jobs. I just want to address convenience. And this is a big, big hang-up for a lot of people that do a lot of driving, like myself. I'm not qualified to go on what it'll do for gas pricing, but that's been addressed here as well as the job issue. I would like to address the freedom of choice issue here, in which the current law, not only do you not have that freedom of choice, you're prohibited and fined if you attempt to fill your own tank. I think Representative Miller's plan, it doesn't ban full service, but it does provide the freedom of choice. If you want the full service, it's still there. And it's still there at the same price for those who are qualified. If you're not qualified, I suppose it would be at a higher cost. But convenience is a luxury, not a right. So that was all I had to say.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you again for your testimony. Appreciate it. And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2749. And
two meetings on Monday.
Two months.
We'll need the session on Friday.
What's the afternoon?
At 2 o'clock.
Okay. Oregon State's here, you know. That's their day, Beaver Day. So they're going to have
Beaver Day
at 5. So Benny the Beaver's going to be running around. And they can pick. I got to get my grandson.